You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 15th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Abigail Klapovich Field from Reality Check. She will outline the foreclosure fraud settlement that was filed and the subsequent rolling up, is that fair? I don't know, of Eric Schneiderman's suit against MERS, the ongoing fraud in our mortgage markets, which continues to have a massive impact on our economy because, of course, it was the housing bubble which popped, which led to our financial crisis, and the over-leveraging of that housing market, which was a function of the massive fraud that was perpetrated by mortgage servicers and lenders and derivative traders. Oh, yes, it's so neat and wonderful. Also on the program today, I want to do this. In the coming weeks, we're going to have a series of, now that we have slowly starting to enter into that campaign phase where Congress is going to attempt, the Republicans both and Democrats, to formulate legislation in a way to bring about a contrast between the visions of the two parties, which, of course, they've got to work overtime for, because at the end of the day, both of them, more or less, are simply servicing the wealthy elite in this country. But we're going to see a budget battle, because the Republicans are going to renege on that debt deal, and I will talk about that today. We're also going to see a possible showdown over the highway bill. The implications, of course, are massive layoffs on a statewide level, which, of course, would cause a great drag on the economy. That's another way to say that is austerity, as we discussed with Richard Wolff yesterday. And in 2 weeks, the Supreme Court is going to hear a case on the Affordable Care Act. And I will head down to Washington, D.C. for a day and interview some people as that is ongoing. And that will also have massive implications, not just for the future of healthcare in this country, but possibly also for the election. Who knows? And we have a whole bunch of other stories for you today that you'll enjoy, including one where Rick Santorum says something just so stupid that it actually compels me to relate it to you. One more programming note. On Monday, this program will move to 12 noon live. 12 noon live. And at one point between now and sometime forever, I will change the sounds on my 360. I'm leaning on that thunderclap quite a bit. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Abigail Klapovich Field.
mind.
All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Abigail Field. You can read her stuff at Reality Check, which is at abigailcfield.com. We'll have a link up on majority.fm. Welcome to the program, Abigail.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So we've over the past week, we've seen the filings of the foreclosure fraud deal. It's more or less like what we were told it was going to be, but just give us a broad outline of it and what's behind it, and then we'll drill down into it.
Sure. As a general overview, what happened is that the nation's law enforcers discovered that the big mortgage servicers were regularly committing fraud in their foreclosures, and that fraud in their foreclosures represented longstanding fraud in their mortgage making and in their mortgage securities making. And so they, instead of doing a massive investigation, they sort of skipped ahead and entered into a year-long negotiation. And the results of that negotiation for how they're going to deal with all of this fraud that was exposed largely by sort of heroic people on the ground gathering the evidence and trying to get somebody to pay attention to it was the settlement filed the other day. And the settlement includes some money. There will be about $5 billion in cash paid as a fine. There will be some few other billion paid to homeowners who were foreclosed. That billion breaks out to about $1,500 to $2,000 apiece. Not a whole lot of money if you lost your house. There are new servicing standards that tell the banks how they're supposed to behave when they handle your mortgage payments and your mortgages going forward. There is a release of claims by state and federal governments that says how much legal peace the banks are buying. There is homeowner relief that who knows exactly how much it's going to add up to. The numbers have differed from $17 billion to about $40 billion. That's because of the way that credits are given. This isn't real money. This is writing down mortgages, whether first or second. This is waiving deficiency judgments. This is a variety of tactics that go towards creating these numbers that nobody really knows what they're going to mean at the end of the day, but are incredibly small compared to the housing crisis in general. And then finally, there's an enforcement structure that is supposed to ensure that the banks follow these new servicing standards and that they actually do the payments and homeowner relief that they are promising to do.
All right, so let's start. There's a couple things I want to drill down on. One is this homeowner relief. And so when we talk about, we see these different numbers that float around. It's $17 billion, but it could actually be $40 billion. This is a function of essentially the banks saying to homeowners, we're going to reduce the amount you owe. But how they go about doing that is important in terms of just how much pain the banks feel. And, of course, that's important because this is supposedly trying to change their behavior going forward. So talk about that. Because I know that we have on one in one situation they could write down the principal of the first mortgage, and yet this actually sort of benefits the banks because they tend to own the second mortgage. Is that right?
Yeah. So I'll try to make this a little clearer. The one way to do this, right, would be like the BP spill fund. Hey, banks, give us a big check, and we'll pay down people's mortgages and help them out that way. Right. That's normally what you do when you deal with crooks or wrongdoers. You make them give you the money and then you go about spending it. Instead, what they've done is they've allowed banks to do balance sheet management and pick and choose how they're going to give homeowner relief in the way that makes it the least painful as possible to the banks. And one way they let the banks make this least as little painful as possible is to let them spend other people's money. And you know, that's kind of crazy, right? I mean, I don't get to take money from you to go pay my traffic ticket. Why should they get to take money from somebody else to pay their penalty? And who is it that money that they get to take? Well, they get to take investors' money because they get to write down principal on loans that they don't own, just that they service for other people. And one, and there's two ways they get to take this money from other people. One is by writing down the principal on their first mortgages on these loans they don't own. And second is by writing down that principal without wiping out their second mortgage first. So, I mean, here's the thing. People, you know, we speak English. First means first, second means second. If I have a first mortgage on your house, I'm supposed to get every dime of that mortgage before whoever owns the second gets a penny. You know, first means first. If you write down what you owe me, if you owe me less as a first mortgage person, but the second mortgage guy still gets money because his isn't wiped out, then he's stealing my money. He was supposed to get wiped out before I took a single dime of a loss. Now, why are they doing this? I mean, this is like, you know, this is contracts. This is basic legal principles. Why are they letting the second mortgage owners stay in business with their second mortgages when they're writing down the firsts? Well, the answer is the banks own the second mortgages, and they don't want to take a hit. So unlike a lot of the first mortgages, which have been sold off to investors like pension funds, they actually would take a loss if they wiped out their seconds, and so they're just not going to do it.
So
and the government's letting them.
You've got creditors essentially in line. The banks
right.
are behind the pension accounts, which hold the first mortgage. And the banks are basically just jumping ahead in that line and screwing over the pension accounts and still getting their money. And now, from the government's perspective or from a third, just a an observer's perspective, What does that tell us about the bank's capacity to eat it if they had to eat it like they should in line?
Well, okay, so here's the thing. At first, I thought this was all about saving the bank's balance sheets because the banks are carrying around something like the four biggest banks, $370 billion in second mortgages that just aren't worth anywhere near that. And if you were to write down those second mortgages to what they were actually worth, you would have real solvency problems for the banks. And so you could see letting them keep their second mortgages alive as a way of trying to save their balance sheets. Mm-hmm. But then I realized the numbers don't add. We're talking $17 billion total among all the banks. There's no reason to you cannot justify breaking this jumping ahead in line as saving their balance sheets. It's raw bank power. The banks just don't want to take any of this hit. They don't want to write down any of their seconds. And the government's not making them do it. It's really breathtaking.
Yeah, that's stunning because they don't even have that excuse of like, well, if we hurt the banks and we show that they're insolvent, it's financial Armageddon. That's not even a play here because the numbers are so small.
Right. If we were talking about in the HAMP program, where, by the way, they also let them violate lien priority, then maybe you could make an argument that if they wiped out all the seconds to modify all the firsts, that would actually be a large number of loans and maybe it would cause them problems. But it seems to me that $17 billion is so small that we're just and it wouldn't all be second lien write downs anyway. It's a lot of other things. It's really hard to understand how they can justify on any basis letting this happen.
All right. The other thing I want to talk about is these servicing standards. My understanding, and by servicing standards, what we basically mean is that you can't foreclose on people illegally. If you can't trick them to not paying their mortgage in anticipation for a modification and then come in and foreclose on them. And my understanding is that the government is basically allowing for an exceedingly large amount relative to what should be the baseline of mistakes. In other words, we're going to let you get away without any criminal culpability for foreclosing on people who you shouldn't foreclose on, as long as you don't do it too often. Is that an accurate statement?
It's an accurate statement. To just give it a little more meat, here's the basic deal. The servicing standards say things like you can't lie to a court. You have to tell the truth when you're trying to foreclose on somebody. You have to apply. If a borrower pays you $1,000 for their $1,000 mortgage, you have to tell your computers they actually paid you $1,000, and you have to do it on time. You can't charge them fees that you were never supposed to charge them. You can't do crazy markups on things that are totally unjustified. You can't charge people for services you never did. I mean, really, really common sense, basic, doing business in good faith and fair dealing 101 stuff, right? And that's the standards. And, you know, if they were going to follow these standards, hey, that would be great, because, by the way, they generally don't do these things. There's a lot of really abusive practices in mortgage servicing. But what happens is these servicing standards that look really pretty are measured, the way they check to see if the banks are obeying these new standards are through very specific metrics. And instead of the metric being, did it harm a homeowner in a big way? Yes, bam, there's a penalty. It's, well, did you overcharge the borrower by more than $99? Did you overcharge them by more than 3% of their loan balance? You did? Okay, that counts. But, oh, no, you only overcharged them by $90? That doesn't count. And then even if it counts, like even if you overcharge them by $100, so it counts, one of those isn't enough. Maybe you need to have done that 5 out of every 100 loans for that even to count as a problem. And then if it counts as a problem, the bank gets a quarter to fix the problem before they run any risk of a penalty. This gets to wrongfully selling somebody's house. Right, they're allowed to wrongfully sell, meaning they just weren't supposed to sell your house either because they foreclosed in the wrong name, or maybe because you weren't actually in default. Maybe you cured your default, or maybe you declared bankruptcy and the bankruptcy court says, no, you can't sell their house. If they go out and sell your house anyway, as long as they only do that 1 out of every 100 houses they sell, that doesn't count. I mean, it just doesn't count for penalties. And this is all mind-blowing because, you know, the banks are so sloppy, these processes are so bad right now because they have never invested in doing it right. They don't have the staff. They don't have the computers. They don't have the mindset to just try to do business properly.
And why should they? Why should they? I mean, if the government says that you can get away, I mean, this is the functional equivalent of my telling my six-year-old, no hitting kids, but I'm going to measure that only if you draw blood. And even if you draw blood 1 out of every 10 times, let's let it slide.
Exactly right.
So there's no incentive for the banks to do it properly if they can get away with a fairly wide margin of mess-ups. And the other problem with this set of metrics that you mentioned is that although we're going to get the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is going to go online soon and start to develop these standards for lenders, is that they very well may adopt these same standards.
Well, there's going to be a rulemaking by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau on servicing, and when the entire governmental law enforcement structure at the federal and state level says, hey, this is how we think servicing should be done and how we think servicing performance should be measured, that's quite a precedent. Now, I can only hope that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau sees this set of metrics for the garbage that they are and insists instead on really protecting consumers and saying, no, the measure isn't what can your currently poorly designed and operated systems handle. The measure is harm to the consumer, and we're going to penalize you for harm to the consumer, and if you have to overhaul your systems, so be it, right? I can only hope that's what the Consumer Protection Bureau will do, but who knows? This is quite a powerful precedent, and
right.
You can be sure the banks will be pushing it as what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau should be doing.
All right, we only have a couple minutes here left, so I want to just turn to a sort of slight tangent, which is one of the things that
had people like yourself and others who have been following this a little bit concerned was when Eric Schneiderman and Bo Biden and Coakley and Mastow and Kamala Harris, when these attorney generals who had been pursuing other cases signed on to this deal, particularly Schneiderman's, he was going after MERS, which was the electronic system which was bypassing the standard way for hundreds of years that deeds were recorded and these mortgages essentially were transferred to other people. And he has just essentially settled on his lawsuit. Give me your assessment of that. Will it be enough to stop this ongoing fraud, which in my estimation, and you tell me if I'm wrong, the fact that the banks took these shortcuts in creating securities and transferring these mortgages led to a lot of the subsequent problems?
MERS is a horror show that needs to end. To explain all the ways MERS is a horror show would take more time than we have, but the short version is the mortgage industry decided that they couldn't be bothered with lobbying to make changes to the way land transfers were done in order to legitimize their, you know, making business easier. They just invented a private system, and they did it in a way that served nobody's interests but their own. In fact, it destroyed the integrity of our land records and caused a tremendous number of other problems. So that's MERS. And the bottom line is MERS just needs to end. Now, these lawsuits about MERS sought a variety of relief. One kind of relief was financial penalties for harm done by the use of MERS. It's my understanding that that is the only part of the lawsuit that A.G. Schneiderman has resolved. If that's true, then, you know, I mean, $25 million, which is what he got for it, is chump change in general, but I can't tell you whether or not that's a good price on those claims because that's a case law issue. The thing that got me really excited about Schneiderman's suit is the injunction he seeks, because if he gets it the way he has asked for it, and that's a big if, we're a long way from that moment in time, but that injunction would simply end MERS. He is accusing the MERS database itself of being fraudulent and deceptive, and you cannot operate it if it is in fact fraudulent and deceptive. And this goes way beyond foreclosures. There are millions of mortgages that are current registered on MERS. And so if he won that injunction, MERS would end in the state of New York, and an awful lot of those mortgages would have to – how is the bank going to service a mortgage if it's on MERS and it can't use MERS in New York? It would be transformative. So, you know, it's my understanding that he did not drop that part of his suit. And so long as that is true, then, you know, my reaction to the $25 million is, you know, mostly meh. I can't really evaluate it. But if he doesn't follow through on his injunction, if he doesn't bring MERS to an end, then that case wasn't worth filing, because that's really – that MERS has to end, and that case can do it if he wins it getting that injunction he's asking for.
Abigail Field at abigailcfield.com. Reality Check, thank you so much for walking us through this. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right, folks, we got to take a brief break. When we come back, I know, you know, look, I don't like to talk about Romney and Santorum, but sometimes they just say stuff that's just so dumb. I need to touch on it. We'll also go through that potential for this budget showdown. This transportation bill, why? You know, this is something that they've been working on in the House for 2 years. And they can't get it. They just can't get it together. And it could mean tens of thousands of layoffs, which, of course, would be devastating to the economy. And, you know, to be fair, also helpful to the Republican chances in November. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this. recall, the other night after the primaries in Mississippi and in Tennessee, oh, excuse me, Alabama and Mississippi, and then I believe there was also one in American Samoa as well, perhaps Hawaii. And Rick Santorum was giving a speech to his audience. And I noted this on Twitter, and I still can't figure out why. But he made a point of saying, we're going to go to Puerto Rico, and we're going to win big in Puerto Rico. And the audience laughed when he said Puerto Rico. And I, you know, I have my ideas as to why this right-wing crowd laughed. Because it's laughable, the idea, like, you're going to pay attention to Puerto Rico. Now, they may not understand the delegate math. It's important from a delegate standpoint to Rick Santorum. And if he can win big there, it's proportional, but only if Mitt Romney gets, I think, above 15%. So he could actually sweep the delegates there. I can't figure out why they'll laugh, and I'll leave that for you to decide. So Rick Santorum is on in Puerto Rico yesterday. And in an interview with El Vocero newspaper, Santorum said he supported Puerto Ricans' right to self-determination regarding the island's political status. As many of you know, Puerto Rico has been attempting, or certainly a large portion of the people there want Puerto Rico to become the 51st state of the United States, because it's better to be a state than it is to be essentially just something, an island that's colonized. And he said, we need to work together to determine what type of relationship we want to develop, he told the newspaper. But Santorum said he did not support a state in which English was not the primary language. And now think about this. Puerto Rico, most people speak Spanish there. They also speak English. But he says, quote, like any other state, there has to be compliance with this and any other federal law. And that is that English has to be the principal language. There are other states with more than one language, such as Hawaii, but to be a state of the United States, English has to be the principal language. And you can find that in article not in the Constitution. But statutorily, if you look up in the laws, it is a law number not in the record law books either. In fact, there is no law or statute or code or constitutional provision that English has to be the principal language of a state to be a state.
Didn't Jesus say that in the Bible? You must all speak English like me?
Jesus said that in the Christian Bible, but apparently in the Mormon Bible, when he showed up down to talk to the Mayans, whatever Mayan, I guess, is okay. So, Rick Santorum, you may have a little trouble sweeping those delegates this time around. Unbelievable how the right-wing mind, how their incredible bias against people who are not like them causes them to make up things whole cloth in their heads. And to be fair, he was probably flying from the mid-Atlantic states down to Puerto Rico. He's only got a couple hours on the plane with his advisors. Something like, hey, isn't it supposed to be a law that they all speak English there? Am I right, guys? That obviously didn't come up because maybe, who knows what movie they were playing on the airplane.
I mean, he's trying to win these people over. Does he really think they're going to sit there and go like, you know what? He's right. We should learn English as our primary language before we become a state. I'm such a terrible person.
Yes, sí, eres verdad. Forgive my accent, folks. And speaking of right-wing inability to see beyond their own reflection in a mirror. And I say beyond their own reflection in a mirror because we know that right-wingers are largely older and white, just demographically speaking. Men, also a big part of that right-wing coalition. And I talked yesterday at some length in the better half of the program about the right-wing's assault. And we've been talking about this for days. The right-wing assault on women's rights. And this seems to be some type of electoral strategy for them. It's not enough that Sandra Fluke, a woman who simply testified in front of Congress about the need for access, full access to the contraceptive pill for health reasons aside from pregnancy prevention, among other students at Georgetown Law, despite the fact that Rush Limbaugh has now lost over 150 sponsors, that so much so that his national ad buying syndicator had to put a moratorium on trying to sell those ads for a couple of weeks, despite the fact that you've got more than 6 in 10 respondents in a Bloomberg national poll, including almost 70% of women, saying they don't appreciate the stance of the right wing on this. Sandra Fluke, you now have right wingers who are combing the web to find information on her boyfriend, on her boyfriend's family, on her boyfriend's grandparents, on vacations they have taken together. I mean, this is, by any definition, stalking, harassment. I think there are laws on the books that if this woman was in her teens, that these people, what they're printing about her and what they're investigating about her for having the audacity of being a woman and testifying in front of Congress, I think they could be brought up on charges. And maybe that explains why. And I talked about this when I filled in for Olbermann, I think it was a couple of weeks ago. Why Republicans in the Senate are refusing to renew the Violence Against Women Act that was just 15, 20 years ago, a completely bipartisan, non-controversial bill. It is the renewal. Granted, would expand financing, but we're talking about an infinitesimal small amount of the budget and broaden the reach of domestic violence programs. Even Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, a Republican. Now, granted, she's a woman, so she's not a full-fledged Republican. I think if you're a woman in the Republican Party, you're like a 7/8 full-on. You get voting rights. But you have to raise your hand before you talk to one of your Republican colleagues. Warned her colleagues that the party was at risk of being successfully painted as anti-woman. Really? Really? You know why they're at risk of being painted successfully as anti-woman? Because someone with the least amount of artistic skill, someone without fingers and hands and arms and a mouth and toes could wedge a paintbrush in between their knees and paint this successfully. The legislation would continue existing grant programs to local enforcement and battered women shelters. Oh, really? And, but, here's the big but, it would expand efforts to reach Indian tribes in rural areas. You know, if you're a woman and you're living in a rural area and you can't handle the fact that you're going to get beaten by your domestic partner, you know what? You should move closer to the city. You chose to live out there. You thought it was so nice in the country, or maybe you don't have the money to buy a second house in the city or out in Aspen. You got it coming. It would also, and this is just repugnant, increase the availability of free legal assistance to victims of domestic violence. Huh. It's not always the case, but I suspect there's a decent amount of cases that when you're being battered by your husband, let's say, you don't necessarily have access to a lot of funds to go out and get a lawyer. It would extend the definition of violence against women to include stalking. And maybe that's part of the problem, because without the opportunity to stalk, how would half these right-wing websites have anything to write about these days? They wouldn't be able to write about how Jewish Sandra Fluke's boyfriend is. And if you think I'm making that up, just Google Sandra Fluke Jewish. It is stunning. This is what a couple of the 7/8 member of the right-wing crowd, they're 7/8 because they're women, Janice Shaw Krause, a senior fellow at the Conservative Concerned Women for America, said her group has been pressing senators hard to oppose reauthorization of the legislation she called a boondoggle. Because it, quote, creates an ideology that all men are guilty and all women are victims. Last month on the conservative website townhall.com, conservative icon Phyllis Schlafly called the Violence Against Women Act a slush fund used to fill feminist coffers and demanded that Republicans stand up against legislation that, quote, promotes divorce, breakup of marriage, and hatred of men. Well, I hope someone in the Republican Party gave her a nice pat on the head, because for a 7/8 member of the right wing, she really done well. Unbelievable. I thought my capacity to be shocked by these people had been exhausted. And almost every day, it's just something. It's like spring every day for their vehement hatred of anything or anyone that in some way could help, and again, could help and somehow empower anybody who has not been part of the power structure from which they came. I don't even know how to respond to it. Folks, when we go to the better half of the program, I'm going to be talking about the upcoming Affordable Care Act trial. I'm going to be talking about the upcoming budget fight. I'm going to be talking about the upcoming potential that we will have no reauthorization of the transportation bill. And highway funds and the implications on our economy for that. But first, let me remind you, this program will move to 12 noon on Monday. And have we confirmed what the date is? Monday, March what?
It's the 19th.
The 19th.
We confirmed it to you right away, but and I am'd you, and all of a sudden, you can't trust us.
No, we reconfirm our facts and confirm them again. And can we tell also from online what Sandra Fluke is going to be doing with her boyfriend on the 19th? Has that been established yet by these right-wing bloggers, what their plans are for the weekend? Un-effing believable. It's just, they should be arrested en masse and see how they like their NDAA at that point. Can we get the drones to fly over them? All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program, but please, I don't know, I got to come up with another shtick, I guess, but we need your membership. To continue the show, we need your membership. So I don't have to go around ass-kissing people who I don't like to try and get other work. Is that coming off as a little too bitter? Someday I'll write a book, folks. Another one. I'm just going to list all the names of people whose ass I've had to kiss to attempt to get work who I don't like. Well, I'll probably put some filler in between. Maybe some animation. Folks, please. We need your membership to support this show so that we can continue it. Every day, I'm like, maybe we should just go down to 3 days a week. Maybe we should cut it down to 20 minutes. Just the sheer quality, jump in quality of this program. I don't know. I guess I would obsess about something else. But maybe it would be just more constructive obsession. So if you can, please head over to majority.fm. Become a member today. Sign up's very easy, simple. It is less than the cup of a coffee. Actually, it's only less than a cup of coffee a week. Like if you buy one cup of coffee at you lay off one cup of coffee at Starbucks, you can afford this program. Your mileage may vary depending on what kind of coffee you get. Maybe lay off a half of one.
I think if you get your coffee from anywhere but Starbucks, you don't even have to get rid of a day's worth of coffee.
If you get your coffee from JustCoffee.coop and you make your own coffee, you'll be drinking fair trade, organic if you want, and you get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. Also, you can support this program by clicking through our link at Support the Show, using our Amazon link to purchase all your Amazon junk, but please become a member if you can. Let's head to the better half, 646-257-3920. We'll take your calls. We can get in a lot of them.